Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. You'd expect a Democratic president to get a rough ride from Republicans. But President Barack Obama has seen a whole lot of slings and arrows lately from his left. Liberals saying, where's the bold FDR we voted for? Who's this cool compromiser? Especially very lately. Outspoken liberals have gone ballistic over the president's handling of the debt ceiling negotiations. A widely discussed and blistering critique appeared just last Sunday. Its author is with us. This hour on Point, the liberal critique of Barack Obama. You can join the conversation. Liberals, are you grinding your teeth over this president? Is he making the best of it? Conservatives, do you respect Obama's talk of compromise? Do you see a fighter? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now in the studio is Drew Weston, professor of psychology at Emory University in Atlanta and a political consultant, well known for his book, The Political Brain, The Role of Emotion in Deciding the Fate of the Nation. Last Sunday, the New York Times ran his big essay, What Happened to Obama? And it's been getting a lot of attention. You can go to our website, by the way, to link to his piece. Drew Weston, thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me on, Tom.
What's the gist of your critique?
Well, the gist of the critique is that history at times asks for a certain kind of person to come in and do a certain kind of thing. And the American people asked for Barack Obama to do a certain kind of job, which was, you know, we were hemorrhaging 750,000 jobs a month. The stock market had dropped from the Dow from over 14,000 to 6,600, and the American people had lost two-thirds of their wealth. Mm-hmm. Their homes were disappearing. And they asked him to make it stop. And he hasn't made it stop, and he hasn't done it because he hasn't shown the boldness that he needed to show.
What would boldness mean to you?
Well, it would mean a couple of things. I mean, if you compare him to FDR, FDR did a couple of things that President Obama never did do. One of them was three things. One of them was he had a pretty clear vision of where he wanted to take the country. He had a pretty clear vision of where the country was, even if he didn't know how exactly he was going to fix it. And he's actually pretty honest with the American people. If you listen to his fireside chats, his inaugural address, you know, he said to Americans, I don't know all the answers to this. We're going to experiment until we get this right. And if I do something that doesn't work out, we'll bag it. If I do something that does, we're going to keep it. But the second thing that he did was he branded the Depression from the very start as the Hoover Depression. He made very clear, we know where this depression came from. It came from Wall Street bankers and their greed. It came from robber barons who are taking money straight out of your pockets because they want to make more and more and more. And it came from a Republican Party and from a Republican president who just didn't know how to handle it. And I'm not going to let that happen to you.
Let's listen back just for a point of comparison, because you make FDR the kind of great point of comparison in your critique of President Barack Obama. Here's FDR delivering his fifth fireside chat. This was June 1934. The recording has a skip in it, but he calls those who fear progress timid and confidently brushes off the names they throw at him.
A few timid people who fear progress will try to give you new and strange names for what we are doing. Sometimes they will call it fascism, and sometimes communism, and sometimes regimentation, and sometimes socialism. But in so doing, they are trying to make very complex and theoretical something that is really very simple and very practical. I believe in practical explanations and in practical policies.
FDR, 1934, his fifth fireside chat with the American people there, back when radio was young. Drew Weston is with me. He's put forth a big critique of this president, saying he's no FDR. But if he were sitting here with us today, I feel sure that Barack Obama would say to you, Drew Weston, come on, I'm all about practical explanations and practical policies. So what's missing? You say something's missing, and you say you heard something missing right from the get-go in his inaugural address.
That's right. I think what's missing is a story that tells the American people what's happened, what am I going to do about it, and that reassures them that he knows what he's doing. And so, you know, that story that I think we all expected on whether it was in his inaugural address or whether it was in a fireside-like chat a few days later, we expected something like this. You know, look, I know you're scared. I know you're angry. Many of you have just seen your jobs, your homes, your nest eggs taken away from you by Wall Street gamblers and by a set of misguided policies that we've been told for years we're gonna lead to prosperity. You know, we were told that if we just cut taxes, if we just cut regulations on Wall Street, then we'll have prosperity. Well, it didn't work out that way, and it didn't work out that way for our grandparents. And I'll tell you what I'm going to do about it. What I'm going to do about it is I'm going to take those people in those blue pinstripe suits on Wall Street, and if they deserve to be in orange jumpsuits, that's where they're going to be. And I'm going to tie their hands so they can't do this to you again. And if I need to, I will use every instrument in my power to put you back to work, including we got a lot of roads and bridges to fix, and I'll put you back that way, back to work, if I have to put you back to work.
That's what you would have liked to have heard in President Barack Obama's inaugural speech. Let's listen to just a little bit of what we did here, January 2009.
Homes have been lost, jobs shed, businesses shuttered. Our health care is too costly, our schools fail too many. And each day brings further evidence that the ways we use energy strengthen our adversaries and threaten our planet. These are the indicators of crisis, subject to data and statistics.
Is there not a story there? Homes have been lost, jobs shed, businesses shuttered.
Yeah, there's a piece of a story. And if you think about what he's done since then, he hasn't followed up on virtually any of that. I mean, you know, he's telling us we need to switch to alternative forms of energy. He gives a major speech on energy and climate change, and in the middle of it, he says, "So we need to increase offshore oil drilling." This was 2 weeks before the BP crisis, and we need to increase our production of coal, which left, you know, many of us, and it's not just people on the left, scratching our heads, thinking, "Wait a minute. Those are the fuels that actually cause climate change that Americans this year are certainly seeing with their own eyes. What's that doing in the middle of a speech about how it is that we're going to fix climate change?"
So you're a liberal, and you wish that he had come out with more liberal policies and not been the guy who was ready to find this middle to sort of heal and pull the country together, but go straight in the teeth of the Republicans?
No, it's funny. I actually, the consulting that I do is all about how to talk to voters in the center. It's not about how to talk to liberals. And voters in the center wanted a president who showed strength. If you think about the underlying theory that has guided the Obama presidency, I think, as best as I can understand it, because frankly, I don't know where he stands on virtually any issue, and nor do most Americans. The underlying theory guiding his policy has been, well, if we just kind of take both sides of every issue, we'll make people in the center happy. But if you think about the presidents who made the center the most happy, they're the presidents who said to them, "I have a vision. I understand where you are. I understand where we're going." And those presidents were one of whom I really like, who we've talked about already, FDR.
But there was Bill Clinton as well. He was a triangulator. He was a centrist. And the 90s, people were pretty happy by the time that finished.
He also came across as incredibly strong. He stared down Newt Gingrich when the Republicans said, "We're going to shut down the government." And this president blinked. And he has blinked every time you've had a chance to blink. I don't know whether there's something in his contact lenses, but he's blinked.
You're a psychologist, a practicing clinical psychiatrist. Do you make that kind of analysis of this president? I mean, you've read his work. You've seen him at work. This is your specialty. Is it an ideological belief stance on his part, a political posture, a psychological profile that leads to this approach?
I think this is one of the questions that many of us have wrestled with and tried to figure out. You know, if I had him on the couch, I'd have a better answer for you. But you know, I can take my best stab at it from a distance. And part of it is that he is probably the most conflict averse man we've ever had in the White House. He just doesn't like a fight, and when the other side pushes, He will just do anything he can to get out of that conflict. And where that comes from, you know, is something that I can't tell you because I don't know what his childhood was like. I don't know what his genes
were. Well, we know a fair amount about it. I mean, he's written about it. We know a fair amount about both his genes and his childhood.
Well, that is true. We certainly know that he's a very bright guy, that he had very bright parents. We do know that he had a mom who kept abandoning him over and over, and he finally got some solidity with his grandparents.
How do you know that he's not right, that this isn't a time where we need that grown-up, that cool hand in the White House, where the fires aren't so hot on either side that if we went to one, we'd just burn up?
Well, I think a grown-up in this case would actually have taken strong action, and if you look at what's happened to our economy in the last 2.5 years, the very first mistake that he made that was a big policy mistake was he was told by one after another Nobel Prize winning economist, we need a stimulus that's a big stimulus, meaning this suggestion.
Supersize me.
Yes, supersize me, absolutely. And what he did was instead he said, well, you know, let's compromise with the people who crashed our economy. Let's compromise with the Republicans who say, no, we shouldn't have a stimulus at all. In fact, it should be tax breaks. So he decided to cut the stimulus by a substantial amount of money, decide for a tax break. We got a half stimulus, half stimulated the economy, which you can give him credit for. He prevented a Great Depression, but the American public doesn't give him credit for it.
There's been criticism of your critique. We're going to hear in a moment from Jonathan Chait. But I assume you've heard amens as well from liberals dissatisfied.
I've heard a lot of amens.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the liberal critique of Barack Obama, the complaint that in these dark, difficult days, Obama is no two-fisted FDR. Drew Weston is with me in the studio, professor of psychology at Emory University, political consultant, author of The Political Brain, wrote a big piece in the New York Times last Sunday that has a lot of people talking around the country. You can read it at onpointradio.org saying, this is no FDR. Obama's not telling the big narrative. He didn't jump in and give us the kind of change from a liberal perspective that the country needed. Here's just a little more of Barack Obama in his 2009 inaugural speech, with all the country's reeling from the Great Recession, calling on Americans to regroup and press on.
Our time of standing pat, of protecting narrow interests and putting off unpleasant decisions, that time has surely passed. Starting today, we must pick ourselves up, dust ourselves off, and begin again the work of remaking America.
It sounds great, but it's a little vague, my guest today might say. Maybe something more like this from Ronald Reagan, who set out the case for the framework of American life that he wanted to see. This is Reagan in his first inaugural address, 1981.
In this present crisis, government is not the solution to our problem. Government is the problem. From time to time, we've been tempted to believe that society has become too complex to be managed by self-rule, that government by an elite group is superior to government for, by, and of the people.
Ronald Reagan, at his first inaugural, Drew Weston might like something even tougher. Listen to this. October 1936, Franklin Delano Roosevelt delivering a campaign speech in Madison Square Garden, announcing what later became known as the Second New Deal. He accused his opponents of upholding the interests of organized money and said that government by organized money is just as dangerous as government by organized mob. As you can hear, he wasn't in the mood to make nice with his opponents.
Never before in all our history have these forces been so united against one candidate as they stand today. They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred, said FDR, 1936. Drew Weston, is that what you want Obama to say? Bring it on, boys. You're big powers, but I'm the president. Let's rock.
You know, sad to say, I've seen enough of Washington that I think the American people are right when they endorse from right to left, all the way from the Tea Party to as far left as we go in this country, a statement like this. It's time we went back to government of, by, and for the people, instead of government of, bought, and paid for by corporations. And that's actually where we are now. And that's what the American people want to see stop. And the Wall Street fiasco is just one example. The BP fiasco is just one example. Washington is teeming with lobbyists who own our government. And the average American is saying, wait a minute, you want to cut taxes on the rich by another $120 billion and then scream that there's a deficit crisis? I'm having trouble making my rent at the end of the month. Or I just lost my home, or I just lost my job. Or, you know, my mom is looking at, well, is her Medicare going to still be there? Is she still going to have are people like her on fixed incomes going to be cut so that hedge fund managers can keep their 15% tax rates? That to most Americans in the center is not right.
How far are you ready to go? From your liberal perspective, Drew Weston, the New York Times illustrator had a pair of boxing gloves hung up on the wall. Obama, you know, hanging up his gloves. Is this, in your view, a failed presidency?
Well, I hope this president can succeed, but so far he certainly hasn't succeeded, except that I do give him credit for keeping us from falling off that precipice into the Great Depression, but into another Great Depression, where I would fault him is that he had an opportunity to change Americans' view of government from the one that Ronald Reagan laid out, which I think is one that this president probably himself believes, which is that government is the problem, not the solution. This isn't a president who said, you know what, if we don't have a problem with a work ethic in this country, we have a problem with work. And if the private sector can't create the jobs, we've got a crumbling infrastructure. We've got roads to fix. We've got levees that are falling apart. We've got crumbling schools. And we've got so many people who'd like to go back to work to fix those things. And you know what? The best way to fix a budget deficit is to put Americans back to work. And that's what people in the center believe. It's not what people on the left believe.
A lot of amens in the blogosphere to Drew Weston's big essay. Tough critique as well, and we'll hear it in just a moment from Jonathan Chait, but a couple of our listeners. First, Steve in Brattleboro, Vermont. Thanks for calling, Steve. You're on the air.
Hey, Tom. I love your show. And Professor Weston, you know, amen, 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 amen. This idea, this vacuous idea of trying to catch the center by going further and further wide is doomed to failure. And I think we may have reached the point where we really need a progressive primary challenge to Obama so that he begins to think about, you know, all this other stuff that, you know, all of us have supported and really dreamed about and thought was going to happen.
Do you think it's out there? Do you think it's out there, Steve? Is Bernie Sanders going to step up and challenge the president, your senator from Vermont?
Yes, I believe if there is anyone who has both the gravitas and wide-ranging support to do this, I think Senator Sanders could get millions of supporters, large-scale donations, and so on. And even if ultimately Senator Sanders didn't succeed, could you imagine what it would be like to have a Sanders-Obama debate as opposed to Romney-Obama debate? I mean, those debates would educate, they'd electrify, they'd enlighten a large share of the confused, disappointed, angry electorate. You know, if anything could save the soul of the Democrats right now, you really need somebody like Senator Sanders and perhaps Professor Weston as well to step up. But we really need a progressive challenge, and there'd be overwhelming support for that. I would go to Iowa. I'd drop everything and go to Iowa. I would go to New Hampshire.
We hear it, Steve. We hear it, and I appreciate your call. Let me get one more, and we'll get Jonathan Chait in here. Kathy in Stamford, Connecticut. Thank you, Steve. Kathy, you're on the air.
I took Professor Weston's piece, I cut it out of the New York Times, I crumpled it up into a ball, and I threw it in the wastebasket. I'm a dyed-in-the-wool liberal. My aunt was a labor union organizer in the 30s and stayed at the White House with the Roosevelts.
All right.
So I'll put my liberal creds up against yours. That was 80 years ago. Guess what? A few things have changed. Right now, we have an uneducated electorate. More than half of the Republicans think Obama wasn't even born in the country. They're guided by Fox News and Rush Limbaugh. They've stated through their leader, Mitch McConnell, our only goal is to take you down. We will support nothing that you do. He has a Senate that can be filibustered. He cannot get a vote through a Senate. That jobs program idea sounds fabulous. You think the House is going to vote for that? No way. So what he has done, you've just got all of these forces. The internet didn't exist in the 1930s.
Yep.
Hate to bring you up to reality. So what he has done, when you say he blinked, yeah, maybe people say he blinked when he chose, I will go ahead and let the Bush tax cuts continue because otherwise they'll cut off unemployment benefits. He chooses when he has to take ugly choices to do exactly what FDR would have done, which is protect the most vulnerable among us. That's what liberals do. And I think you have totally forgotten somehow with a little amnesia, Professor, perhaps you need to be on the couch and have somebody from a million miles away shrinking you, which I think is utterly unethical. Maybe you forgot that he got the biggest and best, it wasn't perfect, but it was the best health care bill in 40 years since Medicare through a Senate that didn't want to vote for it, and with the help of Nancy Pelosi, that bill was a miracle. That bill today...
Kathy, we hear you loud and clear. Let me ask you one question. You make the case very, very forcefully there. When you, I imagine from the tone of your comments that you voted for Barack Obama. Have you got what you hoped for? The hope and change and Yes We Can. Have you got it?
I got what I thought was realistic, knowing what we were. I didn't get how bad it was going to be until Mitch McConnell stood up in public and said, our only objective as a Republican Party is to destroy this man. And then I went, this is not going to be easy.
Kathy, we got it. I've got to move to Jonathan Chait. Drew Weston, there's an amen and a, you know, get on the couch yourself, buddy. Jonathan Chait joins us from Washington, senior editor at the New Republic. He also blogs at TNR.com. Jonathan, thank you very much for being with us. Welcome back to On Point.
Thank you.
You've come out with a pretty tough critique of Drew Weston's big essay. What's the gist of it?
Look, I think there are some critiques from the left you can make of Obama. I don't think Weston's critique is persuasive, remotely persuasive. I think it flies in the face of historical reality. I think it flies in the face of pretty basic realities of political science. And your last caller alluded to many of those, which the most simple being that Weston is betraying a species of a kind of cult of the president thinking, which just attributes all political outcomes to the president and any failure of the president's agenda to some kind of failure of presidential will. Now he's doing a kind of variant of that, but it's a common delusion that basically finds the structure of our political system just too dissatisfying to really grapple with. And the structure of our political system is that we have a system that makes change very, very hard. Any piece of legislation has to pass the House, has to pass the Senate with a supermajority requirement. And those are autonomous actors. And presidential rhetoric has very, very, very little sway over what members of Congress are going to do. They're going to do what they want to do.
But are you saying, Jonathan, that leadership doesn't matter anymore? I mean, Drew Weston, in a way, is saying, come on, saddle up, tell a story. You know, the framework matters, I guess, a lot, doesn't it? Even when the terrain in the middle of it is difficult.
Of course I'm not saying that, but what I'm saying is all the evidence shows that has a limited effect, that presidential rhetoric generally tends to polarize the electorate, but it has very, very little success historically in actually changing people's minds. And Weston's own example proves this better than any other. His counterexample of the bold leader is FDR.
Yeah, their hatred.
Yeah. Now, first of all, historically, his description is completely misleading because FDR came into office promising to balance the budget. He then switched to the Keynesian argument and then switched back in 1937. So he described FDR as having a clear vision, but in fact it was the opposite of a clear vision. Second, FDR never actually convinced the public to support his vision of economic stimulus. All throughout, even at the height of FDR's popularity, which was happening when the economy was growing very fast, people believe that we should cut the budget and reduce the budget deficit. So this mechanism that Weston outlines, in which strong presidential storytelling leads to public opinion accepting the story, which leads to Congress following what the president wants to do, the first part is clearly not true at all. And I think the second part of that mechanism is also not true, because Congress has its own incentive structure and doesn't respond very strongly to presidential rhetoric.
Drew Weston, there's a challenge on the facts, but more fundamentally on the thesis. The challenge here from Jonathan Chait is that you have a kind of idealized view of the power of rhetoric, of story, of narrative leadership.
Sure, there have been arguments since for centuries among philosophers and sociologists and political scientists about, you know, what causes changes in history. Is it, you know, is it economic forces and ownership, as Karl Marx told us? Is it critical ideas that come along as the sociologist Max Weber told us? Is it, you know, is it great men? And we Americans have a tendency to focus on the single individual. That was not actually the intent of my piece. The intent of my piece was to say that in many ways I would actually echo what Jonathan said, which is that we actually have, in fact, right now an entrenched political system where power is concentrated in the wealthy, and where they have unequaled access, nothing like anything we've seen since the 1920s before the Great Depression. And instead of taking those powers on, the president instead brought them into his cabinet. And he said, hey, look, let's take the guy who turned his head away as Wall Street was playing all kinds of games, never investing.
You're talking Timothy Geithner, Treasury Secretary, who was head of the Fed in New York.
You bet. And let's have him and a team of people who come in, you know, revolving door from Goldman Sachs, let's have them lead our economic policy. And, you know, you listen to Roosevelt, and Roosevelt said, those are not the guys who are going to be leading economic policy under my administration. And, in fact, he passed a series of bills one after another, even in his first 100 days, that reined them in. And if those things had not been dismantled systematically by starting sadly under the Clinton administration, but really ramped up by George Bush, we would never have had anything like the crisis that we had in 2008.
Jonathan Chait, what do you say?
Right. This is a completely idealized view of Roosevelt that a lot of liberals have clung to. But again, Roosevelt did a lot of things that liberals would have hated, and at the time hated. If you read The New Republic back in the 30s, it was nothing but the kind of rhetoric that Weston is using right now. He sold us out. He's given into the big powers. And for every example you could cite in which he took them on with strong rhetoric or with strong political action, you can find a counterexample in which he did the opposite. I mean, if you look at some of the compromises that Roosevelt did, you know, even the better known ones are, you know, essentially excluding blacks from Social Security and many of his major social welfare programs, you know, interning the Japanese. The whole National Recovery Act was a huge fiasco. I mean, Roosevelt did a lot of extremely illiberal things. He made a lot of compromises and went back and forth.
Jonathan,
turn
to Obama then. Given the hand he was dealt, and nobody, Republicans included, will say it was a good one, do you think he's come close to optimal? Has he done the best with the hand he was dealt?
He's made some mistakes. But look, every president makes mistakes, which isn't to justify those mistakes. You should try to avoid your mistakes, and he's made some. He's exceeded my expectations going in, absolutely.
What about our caller from Vermont, who says he needs a progressive primary challenger, Bernie Sanders or somebody, to kind of hash this out? Because you disagree, but a lot of liberals are also agreeing with Drew Weston. Democrats are all over the map on this one. But what about that? Should he have a challenger?
Right. Well, you know, I think liberals tend to be uncomfortable with power. You had even more liberal discontent with Clinton, and Mr. Weston is expressing a fairly idealized view of Clinton as incredibly strong in staring down Newt Gingrich. But of course, Clinton failed to get a health care bill, which I don't think was mostly his fault, but his fault had a lot to do with it. He made deals and gave in with Gingrich quite a bit, and said the era of big government is over. And the liberal discontent against Clinton was even stronger than it is with Obama right now. So, you know, obviously liberals were discontented with Carter. Liberals were discontented with Johnson to an even higher degree. I think liberals just aren't happy with people in power in general.
Do you think Obama's giving up on the left-right battle and trying to create something new in the center?
He's doing that to some extent. You know, all presidents do that to some extent. You know, I think he's still drawing some lines with his opponents, you know, in the latest debt ceiling bill, where I've been very critical of his tactics. I don't think he should have allowed himself to be held hostage over this. I think this was a huge blunder by him and his administration. But he's still been drawing this line saying if we're going to have sacrifice, we've got to have shared sacrifice. The wealthy have to contribute.
We've got 10 seconds. Do you think he's on the road to re-election, Jonathan Chait?
I don't know. It's a coin toss.
A coin toss. Well, Jonathan Chait.
The economy is very, very bad. It's hard to win re-election.
Jonathan Chait with the New Republic. Thank you very much for joining us. I know we have to let you go. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about liberal, the liberal critique of Barack Obama, President Barack Obama, the complaint that in these difficult times, this president has not been the two-fisted FDR that some liberals, many liberals, count them as you will, dreamt of. My guest is Drew Weston, author of an essay last Sunday in the New York Times that has got a lot of attention around the country. It showed, the illustration showed boxing gloves hung up on the wall. The headline, What Happened to Obama? And you've heard his critique. FDR plays a big part in that essay. Let's hear the side-by-side again. April 1938, midst of recession, depression, still FDR delivers another fireside chat. He makes no apologies here for the role of government, linking liberty and economic security for all.
The people of America are in agreement in defending their liberties at any cost. And the first line of that defense lies in the protection of economic security. Your government, seeking to protect democracy, must prove that government is stronger than the forces of business depression.
Government stronger than the forces of business depression. And once more, here's Obama in his 2009 inaugural.
With hope and virtue, let us brave once more the icy currents and endure what storms may come. Let it be said by our children's children that when we were tested, we refused to let this journey end, that we did not turn back, nor did we falter. And with eyes fixed on the horizon and God's grace upon us, we carried forth that great gift of freedom and delivered it safely to future generations.
The climax there of Barack Obama's inaugural speech. Cynthia, in Bethel, Connecticut, you're on the air with Drew Weston.
Hi. My comments, I have a couple of things going through my head. I had very high hopes for Obama, and at this juncture, I mean, all I can say for rhetoric really is, you know, blah, blah, blah. I'm pretty sick and tired of hearing him talk to us. There's a lot of we in his speeches and not a lot of I, which I guess you could take as a positive thing. But at this point, I would like to see him make a decision or take a stand, because as a citizen, it just seems like the weasels are guarding the hen house, and now the weasels are on vacation. No one can come back to make a decision. Everything is just is put off, and we're in a situation right now. I don't think we can afford to just keep talking. I think something has to be done. We're in a really critical phase.
There's that sense of urgency. You can feel that certainly right around the country. Cynthia, thanks. John in Andalusia, Alabama. John, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yes, sir.
I have this comment to make. I, first of all, am fully supportive of President Obama, and I think that he is doing as well as anybody can possibly do, given the circumstances. The circumstances being that no sooner than he had gotten into office, then the Republican Party's big spokesman, Mitch McConnell, announced that their priority was to ensure that he was a one-term president. Now, that is not the purpose of Mitch McConnell's job, to ensure that
But that's a critique of the Republicans. What about the president himself? What's the best response to that? Has he made it?
Yeah, I think he has made it as well as he possibly can, given the circumstances. And again, everything that he does is being obstructed. And when I say obstructed, I mean that exactly. Every tactic is being used to downplay his efforts. I mean, the mistruths, the distortion of the actual facts of the matter are so prevalent, and it just disturbs me that we have such a huge population that accepts all of that distortion. That's what's really troubling. I mean, if he could just get a little bit more support, I mean to tell you, he would really be accomplishing a lot of good stuff. He's got a very good agenda if he could just get some support for it.
Of course, he's got to get that support, I guess. John, I appreciate your call as well. And one more, we'll go to Drew Weston. Amy in Acton, Massachusetts. Amy, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I disagree completely with Westwood. I think I group him in a bunch of progressive and liberals like Cornel West and Travis Smiley that are running around criticizing our president instead of supporting him. He's not governing in a vacuum. He's not Superman. He's doing what he can do. And all these liberals and progressives are just adding fuel to the Tea Party. And I've sat by, been a spectator, and I'm about to dive back in and campaign for him, because I think what's going to happen with all these liberals and progressives complaining and even pushing for a third-party candidate, we're going to end up with Michelle Bachmann or Rick Perry, and we're going to look back and you're going to regret that we've got a great president that needs to be supported by the liberal population and not criticized.
Amy, we've got it. Drew Weston, what do you say to that? He's not governing in a vacuum. He's not Superman. You're going to put Rick Perry in the White House.
Well, a few things. One of them is that you know, your first caller, John, made some really good points, I thought, and I thought so did your last caller, mm-hmm. about how the GOP has been obstructionist. They've announced from the very beginning of his presidency that their first goal was actually not to help the country. Their first goal was to destroy this president. The question I would ask is, when someone says to you, my first goal is to destroy you, why in under those circumstances would you say, well, my first goal is to compromise with you. Let's sit down with the table and let's split the difference between your effort to destroy me and my effort to help the country.
So how do you interpret that response from this president in this time in history, not FDR's, but I don't know, is it a difference in the time? Is it a difference in the man?
I think it's a huge difference to the man. I think he doesn't understand bully dynamics. I mean, I remember a time,
bully dynamic, as in bullying.
Absolutely. I mean, he was bullied by Wall Street. He's been bullied by the Republicans. Every time the Republicans bully him, he backs down. And the thing about bullies is that if you ever back down, you've made an enormous mistake, because they'll just come right back at you. I mean, I remember a time when I was a kid, and there was a kid who was it was in seventh grade. There was a kid who was pushing me around, slapping me around the back of the head on the way to a bus stop. You know, I came home to my dad one day and I said, "Dad, what do I do?" And he said, "Drew, you know what? You might get a bloody nose out of it, but you're gonna have to fight back, because otherwise he's gonna disrespect you more." I fought back with him that afternoon, and the next day we were playing basketball together. And he'd be playing basketball together instead of constantly cowering in the corner when Mitch McConnell says, "No, you know what? This time I want $2 trillion out of the fixed incomes of seniors. You know what? I'd like to cut education even further."
But you can fight back, and there's still that filibuster in the Senate.
Well, he created that filibuster in the Senate. I mean, the reality is he created
the Republican sort of power.
There was not a Tea Party until Barack Obama became president and did such an ineffective job of addressing what the American people asked him to do. The American people said to him when he came into office, "Stop the bleeding. Put us back to work. Make us feel secure." And he didn't do any of those things. Right now, we have 25 million people who are looking for a job. We have a Republican Party that's saying, "Oh, let's cut off their unemployment insurance." And he's saying, "Well, you know what? I mean, talk about an issue of leadership. We're about to have the biggest decisions about our country's economy and about the government and its spending priorities made with the president not even in the room. It's going to be made by 12 people who are members of Congress. And the president's going to sit back once again and lead from the rear. He's going to just wait and see what they come up with."
You know, looking at this, we've all no doubt thought about it. And I thought, well, maybe Barack Obama just thinks we've all kind of been on a drunken binge of obsession with our ideologies. And he's sitting back, you know, the way parents might let kids fight until they get the fight out and become rational again. He has that kind of attitude about him. Is he wrong with that?
Well, that's that. You know, one attitude about parents is that you sit back and you let the kids do whatever they want to do, and you kind of make an occasional.
Well, not burn down the house, one hopes.
Right. Well, the fact is that the Republicans had already burned down the house when he took over as president, and when they've just burned down the house, that's not the time to have power sharing with them. That's time when you've got a Congress that is fully behind you. He had an American people who were fully behind him. He did not step into that historical moment and take the reins, and instead he said, "Hey, let's compromise with the bankers who just took away your financial security. Let's compromise with the Republicans who just took away the regulations on them."
Mark in Acton, Massachusetts, you're on the air. Thanks for calling, Mark.
Hi, Tom. I don't blame the president for the same reason I don't blame a woman for getting raped. Number one, it's morally reprehensible. Number two, as a practical matter, it helps the rapist go free. And I think Mr. Weston's frustration has gotten the better of his judgment. He just blamed President Obama for the Republicans' unprecedented obstruction in the Senate. And I think he's really jumped the shark with that. If you really want to be helpful, Professor, what you'll do is you'll focus the blame where it belongs. No Congress has ever obstructed a president like this in history. And I should point out, it's not a constitutional requirement that you need 60 votes to pass legislation in the Senate. The Senate can amend its rules, and they should have done it back in 2009. They failed to do it. And historically, if you remember just a couple of years ago when the first thing he did was to pass a stimulus bill, that stimulus bill was supposed to be hundreds of billions of dollars larger. The reason it wasn't was because he needed to get the three votes of the so-called moderate Republicans.
Yep.
Those are the two in Maine and also Arlen Specter. And in order to get a Susan Collins vote, he had to cut $80 billion out of aid to cities and towns. And last month we saw jobs being added in the private sector at the same time they were being cut in the government sector. So you know what, Professor Weston? The facts prove you're wrong. One last thing I would say. If speeches could make all the difference you think they make, then we would have had a tax increase in this last deal, because President Obama carried that fight and won it. Over 60% of the public believed him when he said that we needed to raise revenue, and it didn't matter because he couldn't get the votes in the Senate needed to pass it.
Yep, Mark, we've got it. Drew Weston, the president as victim, even rape victim.
Oh, I think that's rather strong language. I think the problem with a lot of these analyses that we've heard is that they ignore where he started out, and he started out with the people behind him with nearly 60 votes in the Senate. Remember that George Bush, when he was president, never had more than 53 or 54 votes in the Senate. He pushed through just about everything he wanted to push through. I happen not to agree with any of his agenda, but he pushed through No Child Left Behind. He pushed through a multi-trillion dollar tax bill that mostly went to the rich and that was unfunded. He pushed through the war in Iraq. He didn't seem to have a trouble with a filibuster, and that's because he knew how to marshal public opinion.
Gene in Nashville, Tennessee. Gene, you're on the air. Thanks for calling. Hello, Gene.
Hi.
Hi.
I would like to respond to a comment made by your guest from the New Republic. He had mentioned that liberals are uncomfortable with power, and I consider myself a liberal, and I agree with his statement. French philosopher Michel Foucault argued that our ultimate reality is power, and I happen to agree with that. He called on intellectuals to negotiate systems of power, and I believe that's what we're witnessing in the presidency of Barack Obama.
Successfully or not, Gene? Successfully, reasonably, or not?
Yes, successfully, absolutely. I mean, we can take, for example, the fact that he managed to get this Health Care Act passed. And in addition to that, he was able to provide a federal tax cut for middle-class Americans.
Should he have negotiated more potently with these systems of power? You heard FDR there saying, "I welcome their hatred." Did you want to hear that from Obama?
Well, I don't think that we see Obama back down from their vitriolic behavior.
Well, even in the debt ceiling situation where he was ready to go with an awful lot of spending cuts relative to revenue?
You know, I'm not saying he's perfect.
Yep,
and
yep.
I think, you know, there's room for improvement in that area.
Yeah.
But his rhetoric on the campaign was certainly idealistic and fired us up.
Yeah.
And I was a supporter. However, I think that because of the reality of competing systems of power, you know, he's done a remarkable job.
Gene, we've got it. And one more caller will come to you, Drew. John in Dubuque, Iowa. John, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yes, sir.
I am strongly in support of Drew Weston's column. My liberal friends and I have been sharing it with each other on Facebook since it came out. And there are a couple of us who are still kind of stand-by-your-man types, but most of us are saying, yes, he put into words what we've been feeling about this president for a very long time. So I appreciate his expressing it that way. But really, my frustration isn't just with Barack Obama, it's with the whole Democratic Party. I wish the Democratic Party had nearly as much passion and commitment to liberal principles as the Republicans do to conservative ones.
John, let me pick it up right there, because that's Gene makes something a point akin to yours. Drew Weston, is it President Obama, or is it the Democratic Party's discomfort with power, as Gene in Nashville said? What are we looking at here?
I think President Obama, in some ways, is a prototype of a Democrat who is, in fact, uncomfortable with power. I mean, if, as Gene says, which I think is absolutely right, the Republican Party is hell-bent on destroying him and everything he wants to do. Those aren't the people who you back down with, and I think this debt ceiling fight we've just had is as good an example. The president said, "I'm drawing a line in the sand. The line in the sand is we're not going to just have cuts to people. We're going to have shared sacrifice." Now, this is, by the way, after he's exempting the $120 billion that he had just negotiated of tax cuts to the rich.
We've got 1 minute. There's a re-election campaign coming up. Republicans are gearing up for it. Iowa straw poll this weekend. Debate's coming. You know, and there's a lot of thought on that side. Hey, we've got some momentum here. What's the result of your critique? Where does it, for you as a Democrat, as a liberal, where does it take you?
You know, I approach this. Change that the frame slightly. I approach this as an American first. And when I hear that he's done a remarkable job, when over 25 million people can't find a job, I scratch my head. I mean, when I talk every day to people who are trying to pay their bills at the end of the month, who've lost
their
jobs.
What does that mean? Do you want a re-election or not?
That means that
of this president.
I think it depends on whether or not he can turn around and act like a leader.
So maybe not. Maybe you're ready to walk away.
I can't really tell all that much sometimes the difference between him and Mitt Romney on a lot of positions, and I'd like to be able to see it better. I'd like him to be able to make that statement about what do I stand for, what do they stand for, what do Democrats stand for, what do Republicans stand for, and say, you know what, I'm gonna stand and fall on those values, because it's really about those values that differ.
5 seconds. Jonathan Chait says coin toss on who gets elected next. What about on this question? Will Obama turn this way, yes or no?
I think it's a coin toss.
Coin toss. Drew Weston, thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.